faithfulness. And she asked if anybody would be willing to give their testimony. And Barb and I prayed about it. And Barb asked Cookie. And Cookie's going to share with you. Now I'm going to read it. A long journey ended in joy. Cookie spent most of her life under Watchtower influence. After secretly calling a ministry phone line for 2 years, she prayed and asked Jesus to be her Lord and Savior. And you know, one of the things that really surprised me about getting into the Watchtower is as a child she started reading Watchtower material because she was an avid reader. Can you imagine reading the Watchtower and wanting to be a part of it? You know, she read it because she didn't even have to. And we read it and still didn't want to be a part of it, but we had to. So, Cookie, would you like to share with us?
Oh, this reminds me of the first day that I went to support group. My heart at that time was just like it is right now. We do have a real big group there in Indianapolis, and I've suggested that we call ourselves the Circle City Apostates, but nobody went with it. This is my first time in 16 years to be with a group of people like this at a convention or an assembly. This is different. This is very different. You can feel the Spirit of the Lord here. And we just had some wonderful sharing this morning, which really touched me. We've had wonderful meals. This is the first time ever at an assembly or a convention that I've had a meal and been able to sit down. My husband back here probably wonders, what is she talking about? But at all of the assemblies, they had tables built at various heights so that you would take your food and stand and eat it. Okay, well, anyway. I felt uneasiness at coming to this because I've been in bondage to the teachings of the Watchtower Society for such a long time. I was a little uneasy because I found that we would be sharing housing quarters with someone that I didn't know. And just all types of anxieties. And we had several problems happen just as we were getting ready to leave from Indianapolis to come here. And I was worried about it all the way. And then last evening, I met our housemates. And instantly, they put me at ease. And I just would like to share with you all a little bit of my story about how I became one of Jehovah's Witnesses. The Watchtower, I was baptized as one of Jehovah's Witnesses July 4th, 1975, in Louisville, Kentucky. And I thought that was rather symbolic. And on the way home, it was the perfect ending to an assembly that I thought was with God's blessing. I remember, as I was driving home, there was a huge rainbow in the sky. And to me, that just seemed to be so fitting. That also brought back to me the memory of, I had no church upbringing as a child. My mother always said that she was Southern Baptist. My father always said that he was Hardshell Baptist. This is the churches that they attended as small children. However, in my life, there was no church attendance. I grew up around churches that I considered, that gave me kind of a bad taste on Christianity. I grew up in rural Southern Georgia, where we had a lot of churches who did odd things. We had churches who handled rattlesnakes. And things like this from a young child just gave me a really bad connotation of Christianity. My first memory of the witnesses, I must have been about 3 years old, and they came around to our house and they had a phonograph. And I thought that that was really neat because I grew up in a very poor family. I'd never seen anything that made music or talked unless it was the radio. We didn't have a TV until I was around 9 years old. They came back several days later, and we invited some of our neighbors in, and I can't recall if it was a film strip that they showed us or if it was a slide, but I do remember that it was a happy occasion because it was an occasion for me to get dressed up because we were having company and having friends over. When I was about 10 years old, there was a little girl in our neighborhood that was several years ahead of me in school, and her parents were Jehovah's Witnesses. And several times a month, she would come around to our door, and she was always selling the Watchtower and the Awake magazine. Well, I was an avid reader. I would read anything I could get my hands on. I had half brothers and sisters who were as much as 25 years older than myself, so I really came up pretty much as an only child. And reading was a form of entertainment for me. I was a really good student in school. So when this little girl came around and started selling these magazines for 10 cents, I took them. And at first, I only read the Awake magazine. I used to compare it to, like, a Time magazine that was current events and things like that. Well, as I grew older, I started to read the Watchtower. My family moved a lot. Sometimes I was in maybe two or three different schools a year. One year I was in six different elementary schools. My father was an alcoholic, and I discovered as an adult, I think that we just moved every time the rent came due. But I was blessed with a gift for reading, and this is what set the seeds for me to be an easy mark at the door, because that's what we all are. I disassociated myself in 1978 from the Watchtower Society. Things had begun changing. There were little things said. Policies changed. Verses changed. This meant that. This didn't mean this any longer. There was always new light. The light was getting brighter. Well, by me leaving the society, the Kingdom Hall in 1978, I have been totally immobilized. Because I thought, in the first place, that I was so unworthy. I wasn't good enough. I could never live up to the standards that just the people in the Kingdom Hall set. I was always told that this was a very loving, embracing, caring family of Jehovah's. But whenever I got into it, really gung-ho, I found it to be different. It was judgmental. The red carpet was rolled out for only so long as you continued to abide by the society's rules. You could never question anything. I have been totally immobilized by fear, and I don't know how else to express it, because I knew that whenever I left the Kingdom Hall and stopped going, that I had lost Jehovah's favor. Jehovah was a name, a word that always fell readily from my lips, but I could never say the name of Jesus, because it sounded like something that born-again Christians used all the time. And I thought, born-again Christians, they have a demon in them. I mean, these are the things that I thought. I was married at the time, and my husband, as well as my children, we all became very, very involved in the teachings of the Watchtower. When I left, I felt that if I would stay free of Christendom, that perhaps at Armageddon, because I knew I was unworthy, that Jehovah God would be merciful, that he would remember some of the good deeds that I had done. And be merciful enough to destroy me in the blink of an eye. I carried around the guilt for years of what I had done to my two older children. I have a daughter, Vicky, who will be 27 next month, and she has two children, Chad and Berkeley. And I have a son who will be 23 next month. And Jim is still single. And Roger and I have been blessed with a little girl, Candace, who's 8 years old. I always laugh because we use special terminology in the Kingdom Halls. We talked about B.C., B.C.E. Well, in mine and Roger's family, we still have B.C.E., and it's before Candace entered our lives. My two older children were very active in school activities whenever I started studying, and of course they were pulled out. Everything was taken away from them. I was a brownie leader and was told that, you know, Jehovah really doesn't approve of that because he's so against wars. And look at all these little boys and girls lined up in their uniforms. They look like little bitty soldiers. And I kind of reasoned that there were a lot of things that I didn't agree with, but I was so new and I so desperately wanted to enter into that new world, into that kingdom of paradise and peace on earth. So I sat down and talked with my kids and told them exactly why we were doing this and why all of a sudden it was a sin, just virtually a sin, to eat a cupcake that had a candle on it. we couldn't celebrate any of the holidays. And my little girl, Candace, since we've been going to support group, she's just appalled that Santa Claus couldn't come to our house. She just doesn't understand that she's very, very fortunate that she is going to be reared in a Christian home. The only religious upbringing that I had was my mother used to always tell me that God had destroyed the world at one time, and he had destroyed it by water, that was the flood. But the next time that God destroyed the world, and he had promised that he was going to destroy the world, that it would be destroyed by fire and hail and brimstone. And this terrified me, because I thought, as a child, I somehow decided that the age of 12 was what I would be accountable for. I don't know how I arrived at that. But I used to pray at night that God would destroy the world before I was 12 years old, because I knew I wasn't worthy then. I knew I did things. I told lies. I took things that didn't belong to me. And I can remember I used to stand in the shower, and I just thought about this last evening. I used to stand in the shower and let the water get hotter and hotter and hotter, because I realized, I rationalized, that if I could stand it hot, then maybe I could endure being destroyed by fire. So this was something that I never dealt with. It was just pushed back into the back of my mind. When I was about 15 years old, I've decided now that Satan really had my number and address and everything that goes with it, because the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints called on me. Well, I studied with them for about 6 or 8 weeks, and my issue with them was polygamy. I could not understand how God had at one time commanded Joseph Smith to have many, many wives, when the Bible, the little bit that I had read of it, said, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." I just simply could not understand how these could come together and one could be okay for one time and then all of a sudden it was changed. Well, I continued reading the Watchtower literature, and as I said, we moved around a lot when I was growing up. Every place we moved, the witnesses knocked on my door. Every single place. There was rarely few months go by that I didn't have access to the Watchtower literature. I don't remember them ever offering me any books. I only remember the magazines. Well, after my son was born, we bought a house in Indianapolis, and one day my doorbell rang. It was pouring down rain. I mean, it was pouring down rain. And I thought, who in the world is knocking at my door? The wind is blowing, the boughs are waving on the trees. So I go to the door and open it, and there's this stupid woman standing there with a raincoat on and an umbrella and a Bible in her hand. And I said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Don't you know that it's raining cats and dogs out here?" And she looked at me and she said, "Did you know that it never rained on the earth until the time of the flood?" So I said, I thought she was nuts because it was raining. So I said, "Who told you that?" And she said, "Well, it says right here in Genesis, verse 2, chapter 2, verse 6, that at night a mist would come up from the earth and water it." I said, "Well, I never knew that." And I'm looking over her shoulder there. And I told her that I had always taken the literature from the time I was little, and I loved reading it, was very familiar with what the witnesses taught. And I told her that I compared the Awake to like a Time magazine, something keeping current. And for those people who think that you're always caught at the door by Jehovah's Witness giving you spiritual information or talking about how wicked this system is, she looked at me and she said, "Oh, you really like that type of stuff?" She said, "Well, did you know Christopher Columbus sailed across the ocean?" That's being disputed now as to who discovered America first. But he didn't have to do that to prove that the world was round. All he had to do was read his Bible. And she opens her Bible to Isaiah 40. Verse 22, where it talks about that there is one who dwells above the circle of the earth. This just blew me away. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Then she talked about how bad times are. Aren't times bad? There's wars, there's disease, all this stuff. And I looked at her, and she's still standing there with this umbrella dripping everywhere. And I said, "You know, people have been saying that since the beginning of time." I said, "Why, that saying is as old as Methuselah." And she looked at me, and she said, "Cookie, do you know how old Methuselah was?" So I said, no, how old was he? And she opened her Bible to Genesis 5:27, and she said, would you read this for me? So I read it, and it said that Methuselah lived to be 969 years old. I was shocked. It was like bingo, lights went on, everything. I didn't even know Methuselah was a man in the Bible. I thought it was just an old saying. I really did. It just so impressed me, just these little tidbits of trivia that she was offering me, that I took this truth book and jumped right in and started studying. And we used to laugh because I studied on Thursdays, and she'd come to my house for about an hour and a half and always bring another sister with her. And they would just laugh because it took us about 6 weeks to get into the truth book. I found the book of Proverbs, and it was wonderful. There were all of these sayings that I had heard my mother and my father and older people say all of my life. I had always thought they came from Confucius Says. I just couldn't believe that there were so many things like that in the Bible that were just everyday things. Well, at any rate, got into the study. We went to the first assembly in Cincinnati at the Red Stadium. We sat up in the nosebleed section. I never knew what it was until then. But the drama that I saw that first time was the crossing of the Red Sea. And I was way up here with an eagle-eye view. And I could hear the waves crashing and the hoofbeats of the horses as they were pursuing God's people. And people were looking over their shoulders, and children were in the drama, and they were running, and they were fleeing, and they were falling down, and they were screaming. And I thought, this is what's going to happen at Armageddon. If I don't get on this ark of safety, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to be one of those people that pray for the mountains to fall over me. And that's how I got started into the Watchtower Society. Shortly before, in March, before we went to that summer assembly in 72, my oldest daughter was 8 years old, and she had to have her tonsils out. I was studying all the time. Who's my ex-husband now, would come home, and he would sit in the other room and listen to some of the things that were going on. And it was after we went to the big assembly that he began studying. But my little girl had to have her tonsils out. And she was very well prepared. We'd gone and got a book at the library, told her that after her surgery she was going to be fine, but her throat was going to hurt worse than anything had ever hurt her in her life. But it was going to be just for a few days. She'd get popsicles and she was going to be fine. Well, we took her in, had her tonsils out, and the doctor sent her home that afternoon, and she was bleeding from her nostril. I'd been studying for a long time, and I'd been indoctrinated by this from the time that I was a small child. 24 hours later, I had my child back in the emergency room, and she was hemorrhaging. And they pumped her stomach, and they cauterized her throat. And they put a nose pack in. And they said, Mrs. Bierman, she's going to be okay. Well, my husband and I walked back into that room, and he told me later he had never, ever in his life come so close to passing out. Because the pumping hose had come out of the jar. And everything in there was sprayed with blood. And there was the odor of the blood. And I told them that I did not want to take her home, that I was afraid to take her home. Because I knew that if she had another bleed like that, they'd have to give her blood, and I knew that God's law forbidded it. This doctor again told me to take her home because they don't have any beds. This was in the old St. Vincent Hospital in Indianapolis where she was born. And I said to him, I don't care if you put her in the broom closet. I'm not taking this child home. And so they harassed around with me back and forth. And they finally admitted her. And this was about 6 o'clock on a Saturday evening. And I stayed at the hospital. And at 2:30 in the morning, she went into a full-blown hemorrhage. And I stood there like a fool. And I fought those doctors. And I gave them Bible verses, and I gave them this, and I gave them that, as to why they couldn't give her any blood transfusions, because it was against God's law. That is part of the guilt that I carry. My child survived. She was okay. They transfused her with saline or glucose or something. She was in the hospital for a week. I am still fighting with my conscience because I chose what a society said and almost let my child die. She was so sick that this was in March. In the end of May, when school was out, she was still wearing a jacket and a sweater to school because she was so anemic. She could never get warm. She slept under an electric blanket at night. And I thought that I was following God's commandments. An interesting thing happened after Roger and I got married. We got married on my birthday in 1982. And I always laugh and tell him that somewhere along the line I got cheated out of a gift because we got married on my birthday. But he seems to always make up for that. Well, 2 years later, in February of 1984, Candace was born. And I had talked to Roger whenever we first met. And I had told him that I used to be one of Jehovah's Witnesses. And he said, "So?" He thought it was just another Christian group. At any rate, when our little girl was 5 days old, we discovered that she had a blocked esophagus. And she had to be transported to Riley Hospital for surgery. Well, I get down to the hospital and I tell this wonderful doctor, "My child cannot have any blood." And he looked at me and he said, "Are you one of Jehovah's Witnesses?" And I just froze. Because I didn't know. I no longer attended the meetings. I stayed in touch with the people. But was I one of Jehovah's Witnesses? And I looked at him and I lied and I said, "I'm worried about AIDS." I used that as my excuse. And I felt like a coward. I felt again like, here it goes, I'm not good enough, I can't stand up to anything. And he told me that in all the years he'd been at Riley with all the transfusions that they were doing, that they had never had a case of AIDS. This was about 4 months before the news hit about Ryan White, the little boy from Kokomo. At any rate, he said, "The reason I ask you that, Mrs. Claffey," he said, "I deal with many parents who have sick babies and sick toddlers who are Jehovah's Witnesses." And he put his arm on his hand on my shoulder and he said, "If you were one of Jehovah's Witnesses, I'll tell you what the others have done. They've brought their babies in here. They're beside themselves with grief. And they've taken me to one side and they've said, 'Please.' One man got down on his knees and said, 'Please, go to court. Get a court order to save my baby's life.'" And I said, and he said, "Good Lord, man, why don't you just sign these papers?" And he said, "I can't. If I sign these papers, the elders in my church will kick me out." And I was shocked because all the time that I was sitting in the Kingdom Hall and all the time that I'd gone through this with my other daughter, I thought that this was just the way it was, that it was cut and dried. But I found out that they go in and they actually beg the doctors and the nurses to take whatever means are necessary in order to save that child's life. That was just a really rough period with me. And that guilt, I think, will always be with me. I'm kind of going to jump around now. I met my husband in 1980. I worked in an apartment community managing apartment, large apartment communities, and he came in. And as we're walking along and I'm showing him the grounds and talking up, you know, whatever I had to talk up to get him to sign on the dotted line for me, I asked him what he did for a living. And he told me that he was an Air Force pilot. And I remember walking along beside this nice man and thinking, my God, this man is he's a card-carrying member of Satan's organization. I mean, and he was so nice, but I just remember thinking, this man wears a tag around his neck and carries something in his wallet that lets the whole world know that he serves Satan. Because this is how I viewed it. This is how I viewed all the political things from the Watchtower's indoctrination. At any rate, we started dating several months later and dated for about 2 years, and we're still together. The day that we got married, Roger was raised in a Lutheran church. Of course, we all know that the Lutheran church serves Satan. At least that's what I knew at the time. Well, we talked about getting married, and he said, well, where do you want to get married? Well, where could we get married? I mean, I can't go to the Kingdom Hall after 6 years and say, you know, I've met this guy. By the way, he's a pilot. They wouldn't marry us. So we said, well, how about your church where you grew up? And his parents were still active there, so we wound up going to the Lutheran church. Well, I had talked with Roger about the witnesses and about the political stuff because that was a big hang-up with me. I thought at first, I don't know about this relationship. I better not let this go any further because this man is military. And I knew brothers that had gone to prison and ruined everything in their life for them. Well, anyway, I made him promise me that whenever we talked to the minister for this counseling that we had to have before we got married, that he would not tell the minister that I had been one of Jehovah's Witnesses. Because I knew that this minister would just absolutely, probably jump up and start speaking in tongues. I couldn't handle it. I said, you know, tell him that I went to the Nazarene church, which I did for about 2 years when I was 12 or 13 years old. At any rate, Roger started flying for an airline, and he was gone 25 or 26 days a month. Well, by this time, Candace was about 2 years old. I had a toddler. We'd bought a house, and I was going crazy because all I could talk was goo-goo-goo-goo-goo, you know. And when he would come home and I start to cut his meat up, I knew I was losing it. So at any rate, Roger and I began experiencing some difficulties in our marriage and in our relationship because I felt like this is not what I'd bargained for. I never thought I would have any more children. I thought my first two was it. Here I had this other child who I dearly love. She's absolutely the light of both of us. She's so special. But I really resented it because here I was. I was not working. I was at home. No one to talk to. And I felt really bad because I'd left Jehovah's organization. And I got down on my knees one day because we were having problems. And they were serious problems. And I got down on my knees in my bedroom when I got up that morning. I don't even know if Roger's ever heard this. But I got down on my knees and I prayed to Jehovah. And I cried. And I purged myself of all of my feelings, I thought. And I asked him to tell me what was wrong. Because I couldn't go to church. Roger would say to me, big deal. You don't like the Jehovah's Witnesses anymore? Well, let's just go to this Baptist street downtown. This Baptist church. That's easy for him to say. And then he said, well, if you don't like that, I know you don't like the Lutherans, but look, we can go down the street to this Episcopalian church. I mean, he made it sound like you could actually shop for a church. He He couldn't understand this phobia, this mindset, this fear that I had of walking into a church. The day that we got married, I had to dress in one part of the church. I was so scared. I went into the bathroom, into one of the stalls, and I stood there and I prayed to Jehovah. I put my hands on the bathroom door and I put my head down and I prayed because I knew that I was in one of Satan's churches. And I just begged Jehovah to forgive me and to try to understand that I loved this man. And I knew that there were a lot of things missing in my life, but that this was who I wanted to share the rest of my life with. And I asked Jehovah to please, please forgive me and to deal kindly with me when Armageddon came. Because I felt that I was just turning my back totally on Jehovah. Well, I prayed that morning in my home to not let me sit on the fence anymore, to show me what to do, to help me, because I couldn't live this way any longer. I had this child that I knew would be, I'd brought another child in that I knew would be destroyed. And I got up, had purged myself, and thought, okay, it's in Jehovah's hands. I took a shower and dressed. And almost 2 hours from the time I prayed, my front doorbell rang. And I ran downstairs and opened the door, and it was not the Avon lady. It was one of Jehovah's Witnesses. But I knew. I flung open that door and I saw this man standing there with a book bag, and he was an elderly gentleman. And I thought, my God, Jehovah has answered my prayers, and he sent someone who really knows, an older person who served Jehovah for all of his life. And I opened the door, and his name was Bob Quinn. And I just literally dragged him in the house and I said, I know who you are. My God, I pray to Jehovah. I can't believe it. I felt like Jehovah had just reached his fingers out and touched me. It was like I had current go through me, because I knew that this was a sign that this was the true religion and that I was going to have another chance to go back and pick up the pieces of my life. Well, we sat down and we talked, and I poured my heart out to him, telling him everything that had happened, about my subsequent divorce, about leaving the organization. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, you know, he said, there was a shakeup at headquarters a couple years back. I didn't know anything about it. So I asked him, well, what happened? And he said, well, he said, we just had a really bad thing happen, and it really hurt the organization. Some apostates. And the way he said the word apostates was like he had been stepped in something with his shoe. But he said, some apostates infiltrated their way into the headquarters at Bethel in the publishing. And that they had decided that since the system hadn't come to an end, that the Bible wasn't right. They wanted to rewrite some things. I did not find until I went to the support group that the society had rewritten things in the Bible for years, so I couldn't, you know. But he said that these people were apostates. But Jehovah found them out, and Jehovah exposed them to keep his organization clean. These apostates had not only wanted to rewrite scriptures and rewrite things, they had put drawings into some of the magazines. Well, I had no idea what he was talking about. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, we disfellowshipped him. He said, you know, he said it was just awful. He said they were guilty of fornication. They were guilty of homosexuality. They abused Jehovah's name and Jehovah's people. And he's telling me all this. And I said, well, I know that people sometimes leave the organization. I said, but what do they do? I mean, they can come back if they repent. Because, see, I still had, and up until a year and a half ago, I still had the mindset. And he said, well, they're getting together in real small groups. He said, and it's just pitiful, these apostates get together. They don't, where else can they go, Cookie? And I thought, that's right. Because I remember when Peter turned from Jesus, and Jesus said, don't you want to go away with the rest of them? And Peter said, well, where can I go, Lord? Because you have the sayings of everlasting life. And this is what I thought. Well, at any rate, he'd tell me all these terrible things that had happened and what these apostates had done. Well, in the meantime, I decided, you know, Jehovah has given me this signal, so he doesn't have to, like, hit me upside the head, you know, just put this man at my door. So I started going to the Kingdom Hall in Noblesville, Indiana, because I was in a different territory now. So I'd go to the Kingdom Hall, and sometimes Roger was home, and I'd drag Roger to the Kingdom Hall and drag Candace. And I'd sit there and I'd watch these children. And I remembered when my little boy was little, he used to, like, he'd sit on this chair and he'd brace himself and put his head back and sleep. Used to just drive him crazy, but anyway, he did it. Well, at any rate, I found this little verse, a little ad in a paper about this big that said, do the JWs have the truth? Well, of course they do. Who's talking about them? So I started calling it. For years, I went back and forth. I'd call the hotline, listen to it. Call the hotline, listen to it. Go to the Kingdom Hall. Call the hotline at 2 o'clock of the morning. But I would never, ever leave my name or phone number. They always said, you know, if you want to, you can do this. Well, I knew it was a trick by the elders, so I wouldn't do it. I mean, and so I called. There was a support group in Plainfield. There was a little tiny blurb in the paper, and I got a hold of them. And we talked, and they said, oh, yeah, you can come out. Well, I wouldn't go. They never offered to mail me anything through the mail. They said, you can come out and pick it up. I wouldn't go because I had been away from that organization for that many years, and I was still scared to death that they would find out that I had gone to an apostate meeting and disfellowship me. So at any rate, this went on. Go to the Kingdom Hall, call the hotlines. I even found a hotline advertised in the Indianapolis Star for Fort Wayne, which is 2 hours away. I'd call that. Listen to it for 5 or 6 minutes, all these long-distance charges. Roger never said a word. But finally, I talked with the elders, and I'd go back, and they'd said, you know, you're just weak. You're spiritually weak. Then this sister came around who I think learned these loving ways, probably from the Gestapo in World War II. My husband always says, don't hold back. Tell me how you feel. But she came over and she sat right there and just told me black and white this was it. Showed me this verse about a dog returning to eat its own vomit. I was going to be destroyed. I was responsible for my child, all this. Well, she left. Thank Lord. She left. But at any rate, I was lying in bed one day reading the paper, and there was an article in it about occult outreach in Indianapolis. And I had a picture of this very attractive blonde woman, you know, who was families against cults. So I'm upstairs, and I thought, I'm going to call that, you know, listen to what this one has to say. Well, I'm in bed, okay, my husband's downstairs. I punch out this number, and it rings, and then this voice goes, call hotline. Oh, my God. It's a real person. Oh. It was awful. It was awful. Here goes my heart. I mean, I was just scared to death. Well, I'm laying there thinking, oh, my God, oh, it's a real person. It's so funny. They had the worst accent, too, you know? She had this Icelandic accent. I knew the elders were doing it. I just knew it. So I'm laying there. My heart is just pounding like this. And the phone rang. I thought, oh, my God, they've got callback. And I would not answer the phone. I pulled the covers up to my chin. Finally, after about 10 rings, I hear my husband go, hello? What? Cult hotline? No, nobody's called a cult hotline. And he hung up the phone. He came upstairs. Did you call a cult hotline? I said, yes. He said, well, they called you back. It was awful. So at any rate, it took me about a week to get up enough courage to call this hotline number back, and this same I thought, phony accent, but turned out she really is from Iceland, and she kind of talks like this, and it's really cute. But I called her back and told her that I used to be one of Jehovah's Witnesses, but I didn't go anymore, and I wanted some information. So she put me in touch with Barb. And I've listened to tapes and stuff that Barb has loaned me from Christians who've talked about joy and smiling and happiness. Barb was one of, and still is, one of the most loving, smiling, caring, feeling women I have ever met. This love for her, for me, came across on the phone. And about 4 days later, we talked about things that I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only person who was afraid that the elders were going to follow me around, who felt that they had power to totally change the course of my life and take something away from me. She said, I'm going to send you some information. So about 4 days later, I go out to the mailbox. And fortunately, we have one of those big old rural mailboxes. Because there was a packet of information in there that must have weighed 7 pounds. It amazed me when I opened it and started looking, because she'd sent me some of David Reed's books. She'd sent me other books. I mean, these books were $7 or $8, some of them. She had never asked me for one penny. She had just said, because I care where you're coming from, I'm going to send you this. Well, I sat down and poured through that. I need to also tell you that several years before, I had a neighbor who was a born-again Christian. And we had a hotline in our neighborhood, too. Because every time the witnesses would come out, they'd call me and they'd say, well, they're back again. Are you going to let them in? They could not understand why I talked to the witnesses. And again, I thought these born-again people are nuts. Well, this gal had told me about someone coming to their church and lecturing on cults, and she offered me a videotape on the witnesses. Still locked into this, okay, after that many years. I could never defame Jehovah's name. Jehovah's Witnesses are not a cult. The Mormons, now, they're a different story. And she said, well, I have a tape on the Mormons. Would you watch it? Well, sure, everybody knows the Mormons are a cult, you know, goodness. So I took the tape, and it was so fascinating that in 2 days I had viewed that tape, and it was several hours long. I had viewed it twice. And I started to think, it put up in here. And I said, is it possible? There were so many similarities. Is it possible, remotely possible, that maybe Jehovah's Witnesses are a cult, that they're not the true religion? This is what opened the door for me to be able to call the hotline and everything. Well, I've got to hurry. But everything was happening in my life. I went to the support group, and I tell you what, I made food to go the first time. I was so shook up, I wasn't going to go. Barb called me. Okay, this is Barb. We're really looking forward to meeting you today. Okay, I'll be there. So I made a dish of food. Roger was in Florida. I got Candace in the car, who was 7 years old. We drive down there, you know. She gave me really good directions. There's no way I could get lost. I pulled up out front of this clubhouse, and I just froze. I couldn't even take the key out of the car. Here goes my heart, just like this. I mean, it was so hard, I could hear it in my ears. And finally, after several minutes, Candace looked at me and she said, Mommy, are we going inside? So I thought, yeah, we're going to go inside. My hands were cold, my mouth was dry, we got out of the car. Candace runs on ahead of me, and the most horrible thing happened. She opened the door and went in without me. Because as I was walking across that parking lot, my feet felt like they had concrete on them. My heart was pounding. And my child, the light of my life, had shut herself in there with these apostates. So I had no choice but to follow. And I get in there and I saw the biggest apostate I've ever seen. David Butler was the first person I met. And I have to say that in all the fears that I had had for all of those years, they just they dissipated that afternoon when I went to that support group. And I sat there, and I see all of these loving faces here. And we've got new people, too, in our support group. But I sat there, and I listened to their testimonies and their heartbreak, and I thought, oh, my God, these people have suffered. These people have just been so emotionally abused. And I never thought that that applied to me. And when I left there that evening, Barb was saying, oh, well, take this newsletter and take this newsletter and take this newsletter. And I said, you know, Barb, I said, just the couple of hours that I've been here, I was so upset that I forgot and left my food at home after I had prepared it. But I said, I just feel like when I came in here, like I just had this big garbage on me just pushing me down. Barb ran over and picked up, I don't know if it was the comments from the friend, Golson's newsletter. And it was wonderful, and I burst out laughing because there was this man with this huge baggage. And that was how I felt. Well, at any rate, Barb started talking to me a lot about the Lord, Jesus, the Lord, Jesus. She's one of those born-again Christians. So I started talked to my daughter in Fort Wayne, who's married with kids, and found out that the witness has been calling on her, and it scared me to death because this is all she knew. And I knew that if Vicki would accept the teachings of the witnesses as an adult, that I would never be permitted to be with her or to be with my grandchildren. So I dragged her down to the support group. And we talked. And this went on for months with Barb talking to me about Jesus and the Lord and how much he loved me and what he did for me. I kept thinking, I get real quiet because it made me uncomfortable. I still had the mindset there for the witnesses. Well, at any rate, and this could go on forever. One day, Barb was talking to me on the phone, and I was sitting on the floor in my pajamas, and she was talking about the Lord. And I couldn't go to support group without crying. It's just like this morning. I'm just so thankful to be here with everybody to see that we've all come out of the same things. I couldn't talk without crying. And Barb finally said to me, Cookie, why don't you accept the Lord? I can't. I don't know enough. I can't do it. And she said, sure you can. She said, let's just pray the sinner's prayer. And there I was in my pajamas, sitting on the floor. And I repeated the sinner's prayer after her. And I know that at that point, my life changed. It doesn't mean that everything's going to always be rosy for me. It doesn't mean that everything's going to be perfect. I'm still going to have problems. But at that moment, the Spirit of the Lord came to dwell inside my heart. And I felt a joy that I had never, ever felt in all those years when I used to go to the Kingdom Hall and sit there for those 5 minutes, five meetings a week, and personal Bible study, and all that literature I'd read. And I know now that we are still going to continue to have problems for so long as we live in this world. But I know that I'm going to walk through life. And I know the Lord has me by the hand. Because at the moment that I asked Jesus to forgive me and that I accepted everything he had done just for me, for nobody else, but just for me, I felt something I hadn't felt since I was a little girl sitting in my mother's lap. I felt like warm and loving arms just enveloped me and pulled me close. And so when I get upset and I start to tear up and cry, it's not because I'm sad. It's because it's joyful. And it's something that I never, ever thought I would experience. Well, the witnesses continued calling on me. And I had all these books and literature, plus I had the Lord to help me now.
And the same elder came around to my house and told me that I was like a dog returning to eat its own vomit. And I was so calm, and I sat there, and I talked to him about the false prophecies. And this man, he brought someone else with him who apparently did not know that I had at one time been a baptized, dedicated witness. And we talked, and I said to this elder, he said, "You're wanting to attack Jehovah's organization." And I said, "Jehovah's organization has lied to me." I said, "I didn't know whenever I joined the organization that they had had all these false prophecies. I didn't know that they had one day predicted that in 1921 black people were going to be turned white. That is true. I didn't know that they had predicted the end of the world all these other times." And so he said, "Well, there's new light. We're constantly getting new light." And I told him, I said, "You know, they came out and they said 1975 is it. 1975 is a benchmark. This system is going to change." This elder sat there and he said, "Nobody ever told me that." He said, "Some people got it in their minds that 1975 was a cutoff date, but the society never said that." Well, this other gentleman is sitting there with him, and I have this really cute little dog who loves everybody. Well, this little dog is sitting beside this other man, and he's petting him. And I looked at this elder, and I kept thinking, you know how you'll see these readouts on these computer signs? I kept thinking, I am talking to an elder, because I said, "Did you go to the assemblies in the 60s and the 70s? He said, "Yes, I did. I was there for every one." And he was so arrogant. And I said, "And you didn't hear them talk about the end of the system coming in 1975. No, I never heard them say that. I do know that some people in the congregation got that in their minds, but the society never said that." And I look over at this other man, and he's just sitting there, and he's looking down, and he's petting the dog. There's no eye contact. And I looked at this elder, and I said, "Then I think that not only are you lying to me, but you're lying to yourself as well." And this other man just very briefly looked up and looked back down. And I thought, he's thinking, this woman is saying the same things that I've had go through my head. Well, this man spoke up as we continued talking. And he said, "You know, Cookie," this is why I don't think he realized that I had been a baptized, dedicated witness. He said, "You know, what you really need to do is you need to check out every religion. You just need to sit down and check out every religion." And I said, "That's right. Unless you're a baptized, dedicated Jehovah's Witness. And you're forbidden to set foot in a Christian bookstore. You're forbidden to read any kind of information that someone else publishes." I said, "Why is that? If we have the truth, if this is the truth, why can't it stand a brighter light to be shined on it?" This elder spoke up and he said, "I have never ever been told by the society or anyone that I can't read any literature. I can read whatever I want." And he was so arrogant. I said, "Just a minute." Because I had taken this book that Barb had sent me about Jehovah's Witnesses. And I had highlighted it for my daughter who lived in Fort Wayne because I was just terrified that she would get caught up in it. And at any rate, I stepped into the kitchen, which took a minute, and I came back out, and they had gotten up, and they were halfway to the front door. And I said, "Oh, no." I said, "Please don't leave." I said, "The reason I'm asking you these questions is because you're an elder. You have Jehovah's favor. You owe it to me, if I am wrong, to help me." And I said, "I want you to read this book, and then let's get together and discuss it." Well, I handed him this book, and this doggone book fell open to the Trinity. And he looked at it and he said, "The Trinity, is this what you believe? You believe in the Trinity?" And I said, "The word Trinity never appears in the Bible." I said, "I don't want to talk about the Trinity. I want to talk about the false predictions, the false prophecies. You can't believe this about the Trinity." I said, "I don't want to talk about the Trinity." 3 times I had to bring that back. And he left. Was going to come back the next Tuesday evening to discuss it with me. But see, he had set himself up because right ahead of this other person, he'd said, "I can read anything I want to read. Nobody can tell me what to do." So there he was with the book. Well, I was so afraid that he would take the book out and throw it away until I said, oh, wait a minute. I said, you've got my phone number. I said, let me get your phone number because this isn't my book. It belongs to someone else. So he gave me his phone number. Well, the following Tuesday afternoon, he called me and said he was in Kokomo and couldn't get back. We'd have to reschedule. I said, well, great. You know, I understand you're busy, but how about next Tuesday? He said, fine. Well, the following Saturday, I was standing down in my family room, and I was ironing. Front door was open. My dog was in the backyard. And I had kids running in and out because we have a lot of kids that play at our house. Kids are running in and out. I'm probably 25 feet from the front door ironing. I hear the dog barking, you know, and I stop and I think, But the doorbell never rang. My front door was open. I had a glass storm door. And about 12:30, this is about 11 o'clock, and about 12:30 I thought, well, I'm going to turn this iron off and grab a couple of neighborhood kids with Candace and go to McDonald's. And as I went in to shut the front door and lock it, the book that he had taken with him, someone I didn't see had opened my front storm door very gently, because it's a heavy glass door, and had laid that book on the threshold of my hallway. And that's the last time that I've talked to the elders. It's the last time I've seen them. But for people who think that you've got family in there that don't call these hotlines, they call them. They're just afraid. And they're afraid that if they tell you, you'll say something to somebody and the elders will find out. It's just total, absolute fear. And for the first time since 1978, a year ago, I found out that these are just men. They're not inspired by God. My oldest daughter, Vicki, has accepted the Lord. I'm just real happy. My son, who's 23, he hates every holiday. He hates anything to do with any kind of religion. He has never, ever once acknowledged my birthday. No Mother's Day card, nothing. And I think that he was so wounded as a young child that it's going to take Jim having his own children in order to relive the childhood that he missed out on. And I get angry about that. I get really angry at the society, but I have to let it go because I can't deal with it. People told me the Trinity was a big issue for me. I could not handle the Trinity. Even Vicki said to me, Mom, I can see you going to the support group, but, you know, this fact that Jesus is God, that is crazy. Mom, you know it's crazy. So I thought about it and prayed about it, and I thought about an egg. You know, there's a shell, the white, the yolk. I thought about a light bulb, the three-way light bulbs. And one day, I was watching my husband, and I realized suddenly that my husband was a man, but he was a husband. He was a father. He was a brother. He was a son. He's a pilot. There are all these different facets of himself that are presented at one time or another, depending on who he's with. And I thought, that's what the Trinity is. It's the part that God is revealing to us. And I'm overjoyed. I'm happy. My husband did ask me last evening, and I started to cry. Because he says he's accepted the Lord. But I'm not sure. He's the only one that knows. But he asked me, he said, why do the witnesses always have to talk about Jesus? Why do they feel like they have to constantly express their love for Jesus? I can't explain it to him, but I need all of my friends here and in the support group to just keep us in your prayers. And that's my story. And thank you very much for listening.